I think a big piece of it in the U.S. is a huge amount of personal financial education happens in one specific conservative or kind of fundamentalist Christian affiliated program, and it's marketed through churches. So not only are you getting moral education around money and wealth, but yeah. often churches are offering classes in one particular system that does tend to promote, you know, one size fits all. There is one way to manage money, and it's very shame-based. You know, it's your fault if yes. you're not achieving advancement or success.
Welcome to Money Skills for Therapists, the podcast that helps therapists and health practitioners in private practice go from money confusion and shame to calm, clarity, and confidence with their finances. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by numbers or avoided looking at your business money, you're in the right place. I'm Lindsay Bonham, therapist turned money coach and creator of Money Skills for Therapists. Before we jump in, check out my free on-demand masterclass. You'll find the link in the show notes or at moneynutsandbolts.com under masterclass. It's the best first step to finally feeling empowered with money in your private practice. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. Today's guest is Emily Maynard. Emily is an LMFT in California, and she particularly focuses her work on religious trauma and high control religious backgrounds. Today, Emily and I talk about high control religion. We talk about what it is, how it impacts people's relationship with money, its connection to money shame, how those stories can continue to show up for you even after you maybe left a high control religious context. And we also talk about how high control religion specifically impacts our relationship to private practice and being in private practice and kind of the huge gap that exists between those kind of high control religious contexts and the messaging you get there and private practice and the skills and the mindset that we need to develop to be successful in private practice. Here is my conversation with Emily Maynard. So Emily, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Yes, I'm excited to chat too. I know that what you live and breathe every day, what you teach about and talk about and put out into the world is actually a topic that I have very little personal experience with. But I know a lot of students, a lot of therapists who have had come through Money Skills for Therapists have come from experiences of high control religions. And that definitely shows up in our conversation. So I'm excited today to dig into, you know, kind of the overlap between our worlds of like, you know, I think and talk about money all the time. You think and talk about high control religion and its impacts. So we're gonna jam today and talk about how these things come together. So let's start by defining these terms. Like, what is high control religion?
Yes. So high control religion doesn't refer to any specific church or theology or religious group, but it's a structure of relationships. And cult scholars will talk about the spectrum of high control groups, where there's certain behaviors and organizations that are healthy. And then as we go along the spectrum towards a cult or high control group, you'll see more rigidity, more fear of outsiders, looking down on others, authoritarian structures, total compliance with the leader's ideas, with the authority of God or scripture backing them up. And that comes with secrecy, abuse, harm, a lot of things behind the scenes for insiders in these organizations that might be perfect and polished on the outside. So we're not talking about any specific religion, but a type of religious harm that occurs.
Yeah, it's almost like the structure of a way that a group is being run. Yeah, and as you're talking about that, like I'm thinking about students I've had who've had experiences like that with the Christian religions, but I'm also thinking about kind of pseudo cults that are like in the city that I live in, where you're like, that's weird that they would, you know, ask you to participate in something like multiple evenings a week. It seems like they're kind of trying to control your time. Like, yeah, and I think that I'm curious because like cults I know a little bit about, and I find quite fascinating the psychology of cults. From what you're saying, I'm understanding there'd be quite like a spectrum of like how many of these kind of behaviors are being implemented or built into the system. Tell me a little bit more about like how you think about this. Like, when does something become high control, I guess is the question.
Yeah, that's a really specific, that's usually a difficult point yeah. to manage.
Yeah.
Usually when the leader, I mean, we see it if you watch cult documentaries, like yeah. there's usually a point where it becomes from more of a mainstream group where people are free to come and go and interact with other people with other belief systems, there's usually a point where there's a sort of lockdown.
Yeah.
And a certain sect of those people, a certain segment, will become more isolated and really limited in their interactions with the outside world. There's suddenly only one way to live, and it requires you being in the group and following all those rules. And there's usually a lot of shame that starts forming around there if you can't live up to those ideals.
Right.
Or you don't decide to follow the leader further down the road.
So again,
this can happen in any kind of organization, right? We work in family systems for marriage and family therapists, and it's a little bit of the same. There's unhealthy behaviors, even in unhealthy families, and we're there to help the system become healthier. So a lot of my work is helping people understand which parts of their experience were harmful to them and contributing to their current symptoms, and which parts of those experiences or values that they were raised with they want to keep with them.
Right. Yeah, because generally it's not all bad. There's going to be
it's
a
not,
mixed
never
bag
all or nothing
in any group. Yes, of course. So, you know, shame, like something that I have been talking about and thinking about a lot with my community in the last couple of years is money shame, right? Like this idea that sometimes our relationship with money is so heavy that there really is like a shame component. How do you see high control religion impacting money shame specifically?
Well, I think religion or religious experiences are often some of the first moral education we get as people. So not just from our families, you know, our families all have norms around money and resources. But if you're involved in a church as a child, that's some of the first ideas that you get around, is it good to have money? Is it bad to have money? What ways should you show that you have money? Is money a blessing from God? Is money a trap that could cause you to sin? Ideas like greed, ideas like poverty, where there's this explicit moral understanding of money, I think often really gets shaped in our early religious exposures or experiences. And for high control groups, there's always very specific rules about money. High control groups always involve financial exploitation, labor exploitation, time exploitation, whether or not that's somebody, you know, requiring that you give most of your money to the group. And the leader also lives very simply. We shun money in the outside world, or whether you give money to the group and the leader gets to live very lavishly to promote, you know, the ideas of the group.
Right.
Both are pretty harmful.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think about money and power and how money is a way of having power in the world. It's kind of an embodiment of power in a certain way. When you have money, you're able to make choices, you're able to exchange that money for different things, access experiences. And it makes sense to me that in a high control religion context, money would always be involved. Hey, group practice owner. Do you sometimes wonder if you made a mistake by starting a group practice? If so, you need my free guide, How to Stop Feeling Overworked and Underpaid in Your Group Practice. In this guide, you'll learn about how your money story is showing up in your relationship with money as a group practice owner. You'll learn the four keys to becoming the empowered financial leader of your group and the chief financial officer skills, those CFO skills that you need to create a healthy, sustainable group practice that will support you, your team, and your community for years to come. Plus, by getting the guide, you will definitely hear about it when doors open for my six-month course, Money Skills for Group Practice Owners, for our 2026 cohort. To get the guide, go to moneynutsandbolts.com/overworked or click on the link in the show notes. That's moneynutsandbolts.com/overworked. Because if people have control over their own money, they also have control over their own lives.
Exactly. They have freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I can see how inevitably somebody, if there is that tipping point in a group that wasn't high control before, if they're going to switch into a high control mode, money is going to be part of that. It sounds like, I would think, almost without exception.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's one of the markers of a high control group is they're going to involve exploitation in some way of resources that people have.
Yes.
When you mentioned shame, I think what comes up for me is that high control religion always involves shame, whether that's around sexual purity. There's a lot of people that I work with who grew up in purity culture and they have shame around their relationships and sexuality, or whether that's, you know, what they want, their dreams, they have a lot of shame around that, or there's this idea of not living up to some perfection. And that brings a lot of shame that I'm bad inside or there's something wrong with me. And that can come up around any resource that we have, you know, any tool that we use. But I think it often comes up around money too. That comes up in my work with people.
Yeah. And shame just as a tool of control, it occurs to me that, you know, shame is a very powerful tool of control. Because if you can convince other people that there's something inherently wrong with them, it's going to be hard for them to get grounded and confident and clear of like, no, this is wrong, right? Like it almost seems to me like, you know, there's going to be an assignment of blame in abusive situations in general. And if you can convince the people who are being abused that they are wrong, inherently wrong, then they're going to have a really hard time questioning what's happening to them. Is that accurate? Or would you think about that differently? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also a lot of these groups that they don't explicitly say a lot of these beliefs, like the way that I grew up in very fundamentalist conservative Christianity in the U.S. There weren't a lot of things that were explicitly told to me, but there were a lot of norms that I internalized just by seeing who was elevated in the group, mm-hmm. who kind of had issues and left. That taught me a lot about how I should behave, what it meant to be a good person, what it meant to be a part of this group. And so a lot of these messages, especially around money, aren't necessarily explicit. They're really subtle. But this sense of shame indicates to me there's something there that happened that made you feel like if you continued on this path, you wouldn't be able to be a part of the group, either now or, you know, eternally in heaven, if that's part of the group's
yes.
beliefs.
Okay. So how then can high control religion impact people's ideas about money? Like, how do you see that kind of playing out for people's individual relationship with money when they've had these experiences, like maybe even, you know, like you're talking about after they've left that community?
So a lot of the people that I work with are deeply feeling, deeply caring people, and they had some reason why they needed to leave the group or shift their belief systems. And often I work with people who are years out of the group intellectually, but their bodies are still responding to certain things, whether that's relationships, sexuality, or money, purpose in life, vocation, where they're like, I don't know why I'm still having this problem, but I am. Like, why do I freak out around these conversations? You know, why do I still have this scarcity mindset, even if, you know, my needs are met and I have some savings? And that's often the work that we do is figure out like, well, what were you really taught about this? What did you observe? You know, not just what did someone teach you, but what did you learn? Which is a very different kind of question. And really focusing on what did you see elevated? What, and then how do you bring your current moral or ethical positions into those conversations too?
Yeah. Yeah, that trauma piece is so powerful. And I see that with therapists that I work with too, where even if, you know, intellectually you've moved on from something, these things are still so deeply embedded in our nervous systems. And as you've said, sometimes they're not words. Like there aren't necessarily explicit things that we were taught, but we knew what was rewarded and we knew what would get us like in trouble or, you know, make us belong less. And so, yeah, that imprinting is so, so deep, you know, with trauma in general, but certainly with money too. And like, what do you see as some of the common ideas that people are still carrying years later around money? What are some of maybe the themes that come out of high control religion?
Do you dread tax time because you haven't saved enough for taxes? Are you totally confused and lost about your business finances? Do you worry that you'll never be able to retire or save for your kids' college education? If you bury your head in the sand because you think you'll never be a money person, I want to let you in on a huge secret. All you need to manage your private practice finances are a simple series of skills that you can learn. After all, you already did the hard work of graduating from college, becoming a therapist, and starting your private practice. Hi, I'm Lindsay Bonham. I'm a therapist turned money coach and the creator of Money Skills for Therapists. I've helped hundreds of therapists just like you develop peace of mind about their money. I invite you to watch my free masterclass where I teach my four-step framework to get your business finances totally in order. In the masterclass, I cover the three biggest mistakes that therapists make that keep them from getting clarity on their private practice finances, the secret that most accountants don't want you to know, and why working with your mindset and emotions is essential to changing your patterns with money. This masterclass is for therapists and health practitioners who are running or about to start a private practice. It is the first step in learning about my signature course, Money Skills for Therapists. Register today with the link in the show notes to take the first step to go from money confusion, anxiety, and shame to feeling clear and empowered about your money. I look forward to supporting you.
About money for people.
I sort of see two tracks in this. One of them is this idea of the suffering servant. So that the right way to be moral or good is to live very simply and to continue to give to a mission, whether that's mental health, right? And saying like, well, people really need my services and they don't have access to it. So I must be the one to fix that. And, you know, it would be good and right for me to, you know, take on a bigger caseload than I have, or, you know, continue to work with insurances that are not respecting my time, things like that. Or I see people, there's this idea in high control religion of this prosperity gospel. So the idea that if I do good, I will receive blessing and ease in my life, and I will have all these financial resources. And when that's not happening, that must mean that I'm failing morally, or that there is some sort of misalignment in my spirituality, rather than sort of understanding there are systems of power around money. There are systems, you know, capitalism has certain goals, white supremacy has certain goals about the exploitation of people and labor. And really, I see people sort of stuck in these ideas that, you know, well, I should have financial ease, or I should remain suffering and, you know, not get honest about what my family needs or what my business needs in order to be a good person.
Yeah, and that's quite a gap between those two tracks. You know, and obviously we're talking about a whole range here of groups that have all sorts of different ways of thinking and talking. But certainly that sacrifice one, you know, I see a lot. Because I think already too, folks who are drawn to therapy and other forms of healthcare, right, already tend to be giving, caring, overgiving types. So I can see how that trait combined with a religion that really, or a belief system that really preaches to you that martyr role, it's a lot to unwind there.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the same message in different ways.
Right. I've met so many people who've left formal religious or church ministry and then they become therapists or mental health clinicians. And they're like, well, at least I'm, you know, only working 6 days a week instead of 7 days right. a week. Or, yes, you know, they're used to working till 7, 8 p.m. and being on call in all these ways. And they're used to maybe overworking for underpay. And it's easy to bring some of those ideas with us and be like, well, at least it's not as bad as this other situation I'm in, rather than figuring out like, well, what is healthy and sustainable for me?
Yes. Yes.
And how do I build the practices to achieve that in my business or in my group practice?
Yeah. It's kind of funny. This is a little bit of a joke, but maybe it's not a joke. It does make me think about, there's almost like maybe this hierarchy is not the right word, but a scale of like high control religions, cults, you're being exploited. Your time and energy is being exploited at all times. Mm-hmm. Agency, your time and energy is being exploited quite a lot. Private practice, we tend to start by exploiting ourselves if that's what we've known before. And then eventually we have to figure out, as you say, like what is sustainable energetically and financially? What do we actually need? But yeah, there is that martyr kind of messaging is already strong in the healthcare space, even without high control religious messages. So I can also see that being quite like comfortable and familiar for folks who come into this field. It's like, oh, this aligns with what I know and is, as you say, slightly better. I have a day off, or, you know, I'm not working 60 hours a week. I'm only working 40 for doing, you know, seeing clients. So yeah. And then that other side of the prosperity track, this is something that I'm not as familiar with. Cause I think that this is that kind of messaging tends to be more prevalent in the United States. I'm Canadian and I don't see or hear that as much here. So tell me a little bit more about that messaging and when it's left, like if you're not prosperous then. And again, these are beliefs that wouldn't be necessarily conscious intellectual beliefs, but just like a deeply, you know, again, if this is your original kind of programming around money, is the idea is that if you are not prosperous, something is wrong with you, you're doing something wrong. Like what would be how that plays out for somebody if the money's not coming to them?
Yeah. So there are certainly religious groups and churches that make this very explicit. They are prosperity gospel churches. This is where you see pastors in the U.S., particularly, I'm sure it's in Canada as well, but where you see people who have private jets and they're like, God has blessed me so much. And also, you need to send me $100.
Yeah, of course.
So God will bless you too.
Jet fuel is expensive.
Very explicit about that. And then I think there's a lot more subtlety. I mean, we could talk about sort of the American individualism and some of the, you know, principles that continue to shape our nation. But I think a big piece of it in the U.S. is a huge amount of personal financial education happens in one specific conservative or kind of fundamentalist Christian-affiliated program, and it's marketed through churches. So not only are you getting moral education around money and wealth, but often churches are offering classes in one particular system that does tend to promote, you know, one size fits all. There is one way to manage money, and it's very shame-based. You know, it's your fault if you're not achieving advancement or success by following these rules, rather than sort of teaching people principles and helping them understand their current situation and how to apply some of those principles. Like, high control groups or high control organizations or philosophies don't want you to think for yourself. They're not going to give you principles to guide you. They're going to give you specific actions to follow.
Yes.
And when those don't work, they will blame you. It must be your fault.
Right. And I do see, and we will not name, and I, you know, the exact educational organization that you are referring to, but I certainly see a lot of shame specifically around debt, which would be kind of like the opposite of being prosperous, right? Like, having debt is a very shameful thing. And this is something that I see therapists coming into my program, into Money Skills for Therapists, sometimes struggling with, is they have become so focused on paying down debt that it's so bad that they have debt. And specifically, that's usually like consumer debt. Student loans, there tends to be less shame and charge around, but any kind of consumer debt, folks are so focused on trying to make that go away because it must say XYZ about them. Like, it's so embarrassing and shameful that they have this debt that they do so kind of at their own financial peril today and focus so hard on paying down that debt that then they end up having to put money back on that credit card because they're not giving themselves any breathing room, right? Like, it's this kind of intense project to try to get out of debt and therefore get out of shame that is often at their own detriment. And is this part of kind of prosperity doctrine that like debt would be shameful? Like, or is this kind of a different school? I'm assuming these things go together.
Yes, it's absolutely included in this idea that if you are following the rules, if you're doing well morally, spiritually, that's going to come with financial stability as well.
Right.
That really, if you're doing the right things, right, you won't have these problems like needing to use a credit card to provide for your family or have some basic resources or even a little bit of fun in your life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So how do you see it as like particularly challenging for folks to come from these high control religion contexts into like private practice, right? Like, I see that I was kind of joking earlier about this maybe path or hierarchy of, you know, control, and private practice is a very different thing where we have to be making our own choices. What do you see as challenging about making the transition from this like high control background into being your own boss in a private practice?
I think even that making your own decisions is really hard for people who grew up in a system where they were told the right thing to do always, where that came through an authority structure, you know, from pastor to parents to children. They're used to believing that there's one right way and that somebody else is going to help them do that rather than starting from the ground up and developing the skills and values to be able to say, no, I can't adjust my time schedule to fit in this client, even when I really connect with them. You know, I need to make sure they get to another clinician who can meet their scheduling needs. It's really easy in these tiny little increments to compromise your values. And that's how you end up building yourself your own terrible agency.
Yes.
Because you're waiting for somebody else to save you when really the thing that will help you is to deal with the grief of saying, no, I can't accommodate that fee, but let me get you to somebody who can, to do the practice of the challenging relational practice of stating your fee and saying, you know, I really need to increase my fee. Let's figure out how to do that. These are really tough decisions and they're constant in private practice. They happen all the time because you're the one doing everything. Or in a group practice, like you are helping people make decisions that will help them function well in your business or not.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, in private practice, you are the one who's in control. But yeah, I'm hearing for folks who've had these experiences, that might be a very uncomfortable, unfamiliar place to be.
Yeah. And often we hear from people who are a little further ahead on the road who are like, yeah, my caseload's full. You know, it's pretty great. And if you're not in that place yet, it's going to bring up a lot of those feelings of what's wrong with me that I'm not there yet? Why don't I have an easy practice that you talk about? Or why is my marketing like so terrifying to me? Because marketing is all about being visible and telling people like, hey, I'm here and I can help with this specific thing. And that is frightening for people who grew up in communities where being singled out means you're in trouble.
Yes, yes. So for folks who are listening right now who are like, yes, that is me, hands up, I came from that place. What would you suggest to them to start to heal from these experiences that they had? What are some starting places?
I think part of my healing and what's helped me in, you know, personally and build my practice is that I had to get really realistic about what I can actually do. Again, I was raised with this idea like through Christ, I can do all things. And I had to, in building my practice, figure out how many clients can I actually see and be an ethical clinician and keep myself well back from the brink of making ethical or technical mistakes by working too much. That actually helped me make some of those decisions. Is I knew I didn't want to hurt people in this work. I've met plenty of people who were hurt by their therapist or, you know, a spiritual leader or counselor before. And I knew I didn't want to do that. So then I had to get really realistic about like, well, how do I do that? That means I can't be on the edge of burnout. That means I can't be frustrated when a client, you know, cancels right before the window and I don't get their fee that week. Like I have to build a practice that doesn't keep me needing something from my clients so I can be available to them. So one thing that I think is really helpful, and it's a little bit silly, is writing out your job description, even if you're in private practice. Like, what tasks are you responsible for? What hours will you work? What salary will you get? And you can sort of do a before and after, like, do that. What is it currently? And that's going to reveal a lot about, would you accept this if somebody else was paying you this little money to work this many hours to do all these like high-level responsibilities and deep clinical work? And then figure out like, well, what job description and salary, like what's your offer that you would accept? And then figuring out, I mean, with I think programs like yours, how do you actually build some of those practices into your business?
Yeah, I'm quite struck by that motivator of kind of not doing harm. Because I've certainly thought and chatted with folks over the years about being honest about the impact of overworking, you know, like you're not showing up as your best self. And I talk about that because I think that's a motivator for me is like, I always want to be doing my best, right? Like, you know, making sure that that client at the end of the day is getting as good of a session as a client at the beginning of the day, as much as possible, right? But that's a very powerful motivator to also make sure you're not hurting people, right? That you are not, you know, as you say, making like ethical mistakes or technical mistakes. Because I think that's something that as a profession that's already prone to martyrdom, even before this complex layer that you're talking about, it can be easy for us to not really be honest about the impact of not holding our boundaries, right? And so that's very powerful. It's kind of like, it feels like it could be like a little bit of a gut punch for some people who have been hurt, you know, and don't want to hurt, but that's really motivating is like, you don't want to be causing harm in the world to really be honest about, yeah, what is the cost of overworking and saying yes too much and yeah, having to work so many sessions a week and having that resentment if somebody's life comes up, there is going to be actually negative impact interpersonally from you not actually taking care of yourself. Emily, thank you so much for joining me today. This was like very, very illuminating. It's got my wheels turning in all sorts of ways. I'm thinking about all sorts of, you know, folks I've known over the years or folks that we've had in Money Skills for Therapists. Can you tell us more about what you do if people are listening and they're like, oh my gosh, I need to learn more. I need to be around this person. Where can they find you?
Absolutely. The best way to find me is on Instagram. I'm at Emily Maynard, LMFT. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. I have a private practice, but it's full right now. So you can also find me at emilymaynardtherapy.com. And I'm starting to do some more speaking and training on a lot of these topics. So when I have those opportunities available, I'll put them out on my Instagram.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Emily. I really learned a lot in this conversation with Emily today. As I mentioned, this is not an area that I have personal experience, but certainly an area that I do see come up for therapists in Money Skills for Therapists and in different ways in which high control religion has shaped their relationship with money. And I loved Emily's point about how the messaging we receive is not always explicit. Messaging about money in general is not always explicit, you know, but we absorb the information about what is going to be approved of, what is going to get us like love and belonging and status in these kinds of groups. And we absorb what is going to get us ostracized, right? Or cast aside, or maybe even make us have to leave the group that we are part of. And the same can be true in families too, right? Even in families, as Emily mentioned, there can be high control aspects, and we internalize and understand what is going to get us in trouble, right? What is going to make us belong less. So all these imprints on our nervous systems, all these deeply, deeply held beliefs that maybe were not ever verbalized, but were still absorbed and received, you know, we're all walking around with a bunch of these. So if the information that Emily shared today has got you thinking about some of the messaging that you've received, this is a great chance for you to just sit and be with that and be curious about some of the stories that you've absorbed and question whether or not those are stories that you still want to believe now. Do those align with your values today? Does that align with how you think life should actually work? Because so often these imprints that we have far outlive our actual current beliefs. So there's always a gap, you know, between what we've absorbed and what's sitting in our nervous system and where we are now intellectually. So lots and lots to explore here. Do check out Emily on Instagram. We will put the link for her Instagram bio in our show notes so it's easy for you to find. And thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Lindsay Bonham, therapist turned money coach and the creator of Money Skills for Therapists. If you are ready to go from money confusion and shame to feeling calm and clear and empowered about money, my free on-demand masterclass is the best place for you to start. You're going to learn my four-step framework to get your private practice finances totally working for you. You can register today using the link in the show notes, or you can go to moneynutsandbolts.com and click on masterclass. I look forward to supporting you.